Welcome to another episode of Off the Menu. I'm your host, Vincent Franchini from Tumblr House, here with a catawampus, Charles Coulomb.
Catawampus? Catawampus? Well, firstly, all right, are you saying that I am a catawampus, or are you playing that to me adjectively?
This is a patron-submitted adjective, I believe, and I believe he submitted it as an adjective. You know, it just sounds cool. Honestly, who cares the meaning of things?
Well, okay. So what you're saying, if we're using it as an adjective, if that's the way you want to play it, and you're saying that's the way you want to play it.
Yeah.
Okay, fine. Then that means I go diagonally across things. I'm sort of in the way. I'm tossing things askew.
Askew. Yeah, that's right. Awry.
Yeah. You know, if people want to go this way, they want to go to the right or the left. And suddenly, no, they're not going that way at all. They're going catawampus.
That's pretty. That sounds like you, no?
Oh, you think so? Think so? Okay. Well, what about the noun?
Wild animal? Wait, what's the noun?
It's sort of an imaginary boogeyman kind of creature. Is that what you see me as? A sort of boogeyman, hiding under beds and grabbing children's feet.
Sometimes.
Laughing hysterically while I pull them under to Lord knows what to them. The very stuff that nightmares are made of?
Sometimes.
You think so?
What, you don't see yourself as that?
No, I don't see myself as that. I see myself as a guarantor of Western values. I see myself as a kind of person who's a peacemaker, a bringer together, a facilitator, an enabler, as you might say. Someone who's here to help people overcome their differences, to see their mutualities, to experience each other's humanity. That's what I think I'm about.
Okay.
So you don't seem impressed by that.
Well, I kind of zoned out. So.
Zoned out.
Yeah.
That's not very nice.
What? Being laid back?
Okay, fine. I've got something that's gonna sit you up on your elbows.
What?
You're gonna get really excited when you find this out, and you're gonna see that you're. Judge of character is, I don't want to say deeply deficient, boss, but let's say occasionally lacking.
Go ahead.
Are you ready?
Yeah.
Think you can take it?
No.
Can your heart stand the awful truth about, not grave robbers from outer space, the latest sighting of your would-be protege, Oswald Dupree?
What about him?
I have this unreliable information that he was seen hanging out at Domenico's across the river with your pal, if that's the word I could use, the boss of the other side, Don Giuseppe Manicotti. Uh-huh. The great rival to the Franchinis, the Manicottis. The ones whom Officer Clancy protected us against for many, many years when he was still walking the beat. And your pal, the worthless scumbag they call Oswald Dupree, is hanging out with Don Giuseppe.
Does that concern you?
It doesn't concern me. I'm in Austria. It should concern you.
Why?
You've given him access to the Tumblr House Tower, and there he is... you know, eating the pasta fagioli and the cannelloni there with Don Giuseppe. That doesn't concern you?
You know, it doesn't surprise me that this would alarm you. So let me teach you how to do business, okay? You keep your friends close, but your enemies closer. Ever heard of that one, Charles?
I have. So you're admitting that Oswald's your enemy?
He's a wild card. He's a wild card.
Oh, chaotic neutral?
Well, it makes sense that your doppelganger would be similar in that regard, yes.
He's not my doppelganger. He doesn't look anything like me. Have you ever seen a Jufro on this head? I don't think so. Do I dress in double knits? Do I have to wear a chest wig? No, I don't think so. He doesn't look anything like me. Maybe the face a little. Well, maybe more than a little, but still. And that's not all. You know who else he's been seen with?
Who?
One of your favorite people of recent moments.
Who?
You know.
No, I don't know.
Yes, you do.
I don't want to know, Charles.
He's been seen with Murray Schwartz.
Okay, tell everybody about Murray Schwartz.
I'm not telling you about Murray Schwartz. He's your friend. You brought him up.
No, you just brought him up, mentioning that Oswald was seen with him.
Well, there you go. This doesn't concern you.
Okay, good. All right, moving on. What's new, Charles?
Gerbils. Gerbils, guinea pigs, and buttons.
What about that stupid cat?
Oh, Mrs. Malloy's cat was not
What about
stupid. See, I think what it is that you've got a resentment toward alternative and parallel developments.
What did you say before? Like a surreal escape hatch?
This is what they provide you, a surreal escape hatch from the horrors of a reality gone awry. Look, see this? Let me show you reality, boss man. Look. That's reality. Got it?
Got it.
Now, in the face of that, you tell me it isn't better to think about Murray Schwartz and Mrs. Malloy's cat.
I guess.
I got you there. You now have a scapegoat upon whom you can blame all your problems.
Why? Tell us more about. No, you know what? No, don't do
You're
that.
frightened.
Okay, let's see. I
You're
have to reconfigure
frightened.
myself
You
here. Okay.
don't
Okay.
want to go the rabbit down the rabbit hole.
Where do we go from here, Charles? Where do we take
Well,
the show? You're steering the ship.
oh, am I? Well,
Yeah.
if I'm steering the ship,
Yeah.
in that case, oh, look at those rocks. They look very interesting. Let's have a closer look. No, I'm not going to do that. Instead, I'm going to do something quasi-useful. The first is I would like to give out not one, not two, but three literary shout-outs. I'd like to mention a couple of works that have recently appeared that I really think should be, read by our adoring friends, fans, and public. The first is the heartwarming story of Dubby, the Double Eagle, by the inimitable Edward von Habsburg. Or Edward Habsburg-Lothringen, as you might say. The Dubby the Double-Headed Eagle. It's a fun book, and like all children's books, is, how do I put it? Kids enjoy it and all that, but adults get a lot more out of it. The same could be said for Saint Nick's Journey by my friend Keith Mayhew Hammond. Up in the wilds of Toronto, Ontario. Well, all right, actually. He's in Oshawa, but we'll say Toronto because nobody down here knows where Oshawa is.
That's how
Or
you
cares,
pronounce
really.
it?
What, Oshawa?
Are you pronouncing Ottawa?
No, that's Ottawa.
What's
Oshawa is pronounced
Oshawa?
Oshawa. Oshawa isn't a what, it's a where. It's a town on the lake a bit east of Toronto.
Okay.
Oshawa. You've never heard of Oshawa?
No.
In
But
fact, it
I'm not
used to be.
Canadian.
You're not. Guy Lombardo was Canadian. He called his band the Royal Canadians. He was Italian.
Great.
So how come you're not Canadian?
Because my family hates Canada.
How
Never
come you
went
don't have a
there.
band?
Because my family hates bands.
Well.
I can say crazy things too. Yeah. I can just spout gibberish. Yeah. Okay, but let me be really serious for a second. Dubby, available at Tumblr House Bookstore for $12.99. Recommended reading ages 6 to 12. I finished this. I'm halfway through this. It's very cute. Very cute. So highly recommended.
Yeah, but I have a question for you.
Yeah.
What would you recommend they order it with? Because, see, they're going to have to pay shipping and handling if that's the only thing they get.
Well, if they could order that with Star Spangled Crown, and that would combine for $26.
And that would give them
free shipping and handling.
Wow, isn't really?
Isn't that unbelievable, Charles?
That's amazing. Act now while supplies last.
Void where prohibited. Sorry, no CODs.
Operators are standing by to take your call.
Act now. Batteries not included.
Be the first on your block. So, not an actor. I don't know who that's referring. But no, seriously. So a couple of shout-outs on those two books. And let's see, what else? There was something else. Oh, yeah. Very, very important thing. Today, in real time.
It was the third book.
Oh, the third book. I'm glad you asked that. The third is My Life and Crimes by Don Giuseppe Mannicotti.
Okay, what's clean. New, Charles?
He comes clean. He tells everything. Well, he names names. You don't seem impressed.
All right. Well, you know, that's just... Honestly, you want to know the terrible truth is that book isn't in the Tumblr House bookstore. So, yeah, does it really exist?
So, I see. As far as you're concerned, it's dead to you. Yeah. Well, I'll just make one more comment about it, and that is, I think Don Giuseppe is pretty smart because in coming clean and writing a tell-all book, he figures he's going to make more money for the Mannicotti family than all of their illegal enterprises put together. And that shows you the world we live in today.
All right.
All right. The other important thing is that today, in real time, is March the 6th, which is the Feast of Saints Felicitas and Perpetua, which the Roman lady and her slave, who were both Christians, and were martyred. But they also gave their name to a local parish church. And which church was that? Yes, Saints Felicitas and Perpetua. We know this. But what town is it in?
It's in San Marino.
Exactly. And what do we know San Marino as?
What do we know San... what, the rich white town? What? I don't get it.
Yeah, well, formerly, now it's San Marino. But no, it was what... it was a big bastion of old money in our area.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean old money, not immigrants coming in and making tons of dough out of a network of shady businesses. I mean old WASP money.
Great. I love old WASP money.
Yeah, I know. I've seen some of it on your wall. It's great.
Yeah, wonderful.
Oh, speaking of which, we get to the memes of production. Are you going to mention the comment on Tyrone?
Yes. You want me to do that now? Let's do it.
No, we could, but I just want to make a quick comment about Tyrone, that I think he's been getting a certain amount of adverse publicity around the tower.
Why?
Well, people have accused him, and mind you, I love Tyrone like a third cousin, and he's a nice guy. Little bit of a temper. I think that's true. But I think that one of the things that is going to be in the memes of production, if I remember correctly, is very unjust. Saying he carries a billy club in the whip hand.
Look, Charles, I recommend you be on Tyrone's good side because he will go to bat for you, literally.
Oh, I know. Or on me, as the case may be. But the thing is, I was just going to observe that his billy club is usually on his belt, not in his whip hand.
Okay.
I mean, it would give the impression that he walks around looking for somebody to smack, and that's just not true.
All right, anything else going on?
Well, let's see.
March 8th, this
March
airs.
8th. Gosh, I don't remember who the patron saint is on March 8th. March 5th, incidentally, was Saint Piran, the patron saint of Cornwall. So that's one of four, count them, four Celtic saints in the month of March. We came in with Saint David of Wales. The fifth, we've got Saint Piran of Cornwall. St. Patrick's Day is coming up on March the 17th, but on St. Patrick's Day is one of my favorite saints, St. Joseph of Arimathea, who gave the tomb to our Lord that we now know as the Holy Sepulchre, and who, so we're told, founded Glastonbury. So I'm a big St. Joseph of Arimathea fan.
Okay, excellent.
And you know what comes 2 days after him?
Who?
I shouldn't have to tell an Italian. This is March. It's the month of whom? In
What,
the year of
Saint
whom?
Joseph?
Yes, St. Joseph. Are you going to be going to a St. Joseph's table this year?
I don't know. The one is pretty deep into LA. That, what is it, in at St. Peter's, I think.
Yeah, St. Peter's.
Yeah, maybe.
I know some years the Italian Catholic Federation do one at Holy Angels.
Yeah.
I don't know if they're gonna do one this year though.
I don't think so. They're pretty strict over there when it comes to COVID. So,
Are they still taking money?
oh, they're taking money, all right. All right.
The strictness there's a limit to how
Well,
strict they
it's
are.
charity. So they don't
Ah.
actually need to do anything. All right.
Okay.
Anyhow.
Okay. If you ever give up being a despotic multimillionaire, you might consider becoming a spokesperson for a diocese.
Thank you, Charles.
Very welcome.
Okay, moving on. So first, I'd just like to apologize for the technical problems, a little bit of audio difficulties. We tried to fix it, couldn't, but it's okay. Good enough for the show. So
Good enough for government work.
that's right. So, let us move on to the memes of production. So, oh, wait a minute, wait a minute, wait a minute. Before that, because we have a comment. So we talked about Wikipedia activism on the
Yes.
last show, and so someone put a really interesting comment that I felt was really worth reading. Let me enlarge this. All right, from the National Distributist. The problem with wiki activism is their reliable sources policy. This relates to the flag on Charles Coulomb's article about it being too reliant on primary sources. Wikipedia's stated mission is to summarize prestige sources, for example, MSM and academic sources. Those sources obviously have a left-wing bias. That provides ample ammunition for the left-wing editors who want it. Eventually, conservative editors get discouraged because they are reliant on these left-leaning sources and quit Wikipedia, which compounds the problem because the left-wing editors remain and are emboldened. So that makes sense, right?
Yeah.
So really illustrates things.
So be tough and search out sources that the morons can't argue with.
Wow, that's a tall order.
I know. But the good point to it is that you've got virtually everything that's in the public domain at your fingertips.
Yep, very true. All right, now time for the memes of production.
Nationalize the means of production.
For the common good.
Urgh.
All right, let's get started. Whoa, you're frozen. You're locked up. There we go. Okay. All right. Catholic Ben Shapiro says, waiting for the Tumblr Tower leaks. And Todd Bird rightly says, If you think Vincent would allow some ersatz Julian Assange to make it 5 minutes without a visit from Tyrone, you aren't paying attention. Couldn't have said it better myself.
That is so true. I mean, I'll tell you what. If somebody tried to blow the whistle on your operation, boss, let's just say he found out what a billy club to the kidneys be like.
Sad, you know, just so misguided. You know, these people, they get these ideas in their mind. Just sad. It didn't need to be like that, you know?
Anyhow. Well, I have to admit, I did warn the guy.
I know.
I said, you know, I really wouldn't do that if I were you. And you know what he said to me?
What?
You don't know anything about IT.
What, information technology? What?
Yeah. Well, okay. You remember, he had that, what do you call those little thingies? You stick them in computers, you fill them up with information, you pull
flash
them out
drives.
Again. That's the one. You remember, he had the flash drive on him when he was about to leave. And somebody tipped the wink to Tyrone and the gang. And, well, the results weren't pretty. You got your flash drive back, which was, I guess, okay. But, that was a very sad incident.
Yeah, well,
I told him I didn't think he was smart, but he said I didn't know what I was talking about. Uh-huh.
That's how it goes. So, all right, next one. Let's see, some more comments from Anthony Stein, who's has the moniker Return to Tradition. That's his channel. And he says, the pre-show is great. It's always a highlight of my Sunday after the mass when it gets uploaded. And Bothia says, you're here too. Awesome. I might just have to become a patron. Anthony replies, I recommend it. The pre-show is worth the buck. And Three Cedars Homestead says, you're a fellow gardener, which is the first, you know, the first tier of becoming a patron. And Anthony replies, I was. I got a promotion after an incident with planting poison ivy on the tower walls. See, now, this is what I'm talking about. See, there's so much criticism directed toward the top floor that we don't listen to our employees. I think this is perfect. This shows perfectly that we do listen and that we do empower our employees, that even a lowly gardener can innovate, right?
Yeah, I'll say. That the poison ivy on the walls trick was I knew something was up because half the kids in the neighborhood ended up having poison ivy on their hands.
And that'll teach them. You'll never hear from them again.
No, probably not. The most we'll get is egged occasionally. But I remember the incident very, very well. Huh. So it came from Anthony Stein. Well, as you say, innovation can be found in the strangest places.
All right, so it just goes to show you, we listen to our employees, Charles.
Yeah, that's for sure.
All right. All right, on to the questions, shall we?
I don't know. I'm at a place in my career, in my life. I'm kind of torn, and actually I don't mind saying this in front of our audience. I don't really know which way I want to go with the rest of my life. I'm 60 years old. What do you think? Nuclear physicist or model?
Well, I would go with model.
Model? You
I think it pays better.
So you think the graveyard blonde hair?
These things are cyclical. And, you know, that's been out of fashion for so long, I think it's coming back in.
All right. Well, I'll certainly take that under advisement. I think I could become a model like, I don't know, Twiggy.
Yeah, good old Twiggy. Okay, on to the questions.
All right. You haven't thought of Twiggy in 25 years.
Yep. Thanks for bringing Twiggy up. All right.
You know, Twiggy just doesn't get enough. Feed Twiggy. Why, this is why This is it. This is why this abomination of desolation has been visited upon the world. We have neglected Twiggy.
The biblical prophecy of the abomination of desolation has been unleashed on the world because we've neglected Twiggy?
Yes. Why do you think we have COVID? Because nobody talks about Twiggy anymore. When I was a kid, you heard about Twiggy all the time. She was on talk shows, game shows, laugh it. You never hear about Twiggy now.
What a sad day.
I'm saying.
Unbelievable.
You know, I think everyone here, everyone listening to this broadcast, should make it part of their Lenten discipline to tell everyone about Twiggy. Everyone they know.
Well, what if they don't know anything about Twiggy?
Well, then what they do is they go to Wikipedia, Source of All Truth, and they find out everything about Twiggy. Including if she's got a website, you know, twiggy.com or something. And if they do, they can look it up. And I don't know. I wonder if she does have a website.
All right. Questions time.
You don't want to talk about Twiggy, in other words.
No.
All right. Fine. But this is why the country's going to hell in a handbasket. Do you think Biden would have been elected if Twiggy were given the proper recognition she deserves? I don't think so. I think I've just diagnosed the entire nation's problem right here, right now. It's Twiggy neglect that has brought us to this terrible point in time.
Charles, I'm going to lock you in a room, bind you to a chair, and I'm going to play Sugar Shack on loop for 24 hours. Sugar Shack. That's what we're going to do.
Simply because I'm alerting the public as to the dangers of Twiggy neglect syndrome. So, that's what the country is suffering from.
Watch yourself.
TNS.
Watch yourself. All right.
Twiggy neglect syndrome. The whole country is suffering. I'm as guilty as anyone else.
Get a grip, man. You're losing it.
Well, it's my fault, too. I participated in this neglect. I haven't thought about Twiggy either. I repent of my sin. Twiggy, forgive me.
All right. Snap out of it. Just take a deep breath. Count to 10.
I just feel so torn apart by this shame.
Okay.
All right. It's all right. Twiggy will prevail. Trust the plan.
All right.
Maybe that's what Q. Do you think Twiggy is Q?
All right. Gavin Newsom.
Gavin Newsom is Q?
Cardinal Supich.
Oh. Okay, I see what you're getting at.
I'm trying to bring you down. I'm trying to moderate this, and I have to use unconventional means. I have to use certain buzzwords to elicit a behavioral response that I'm looking for here.
What? Nausea?
All right. Questions.
Vomitosity? Questions. All right, fine. Be that way.
All right. First question from Anonymous. You can do it, Charles. I believe in you. I have faith in you.
What if it's Twiggy posing as Anonymous?
I would respond to you, but I can't respond to you because that would just, like, you would just take it further. All right.
Be a code message from Twiggy. It could be. You don't know. Go ahead. Give us the question and then we'll decide.
Okay. All right. From Anonymous. I have a rather personal and risque question to ask you. I have been
That's not
deal.
Twiggy. That's not Twiggy. All right, we're all right. Go ahead. That's not Twiggy.
I have been dealing for years with an addiction to pornography and the other bodily impulse commonly associated with this vile practice.
It's really not Twiggy.
I've been talking to many other young men like myself who may be struggling with this, and this Lent have made it part of my abstinence by praying specifically to our Most Holy Mother Mary, Queen of Saints, for purity of thought and action. Would you consider these sins grave matter or even mortal sins? These ones stand out to me, out the most to me in the confessional and are the hardest to confess to. I humbly ask to pray for anyone who struggles with this. It's corruption of the masculine virtue and the desecration of the feminine.
Yeah, that's definitely not Twiggy. Well, a couple of things. One is it's a mortal sin. So which means, and let's apart from the fact that you'd go to hell if you died that way, you can't receive communion until you've got a confession. So how does one deal with it? Well, there are a number of things to be done, actually. And I know that for young men, this can be seem like an overwhelming pile of guilt. First thing you do is put that aside and try to look at it clinically. That is to say, it is a problem that has to be dealt with, that has to be repaired. But don't give it any more control over your attention than you absolutely have to. What do I mean by that? Well, first and foremost, when the temptation hits, immediately pray to the Blessed Mother, pray to our Lord. Avoid the occasions. Usually, you've got an idea of what's going to go down that route. So try to head it off at the pass. And that try, by the way, brings me to another important point. And this is true not just of this one, but of any habitual sin. And this is really, really, I think, an important technique. One of the ways in which we batter down our own resistance to habitual sins is to remind ourselves that they're habitual, and so we're sure to fall sooner or later. The trick then is to say, well, maybe that's true, but not now. Not this time. And then go as soon as you possibly can to confession if you do fall. And I mean, as soon as you possibly can, because you can't receive otherwise. And that brings me to another point, which is receive communion as often as you can, daily if possible, and go to confession as often as you fall to a mortal sin, or if you don't, weekly. Why? Well, a couple of reasons. You'll build up your virtue over a long period of time, you build up your resistance. Also, if you get into the habit of going to communion every day, one of the things that will mitigate against your sinning in this way is that you're not going to want to have to miss it. Because that's the funny thing about frequent communion. It's not that you'll feel different, but when you can't receive for some reason, that's when you feel it. It's a very strange thing. It's only weekly, it doesn't have the same oomph, but if you try to go daily and then on a given day you can't because you succumbed, that in itself over time becomes a factor in restraining it. And don't be afraid to go don't be the slightest bit afraid of talking about it in the confessional. Just throw it out there. Don't worry about it. The priest doesn't care. I mean, I've known at least one or two who had, shall we say, unhealthy fascinations with it. But by and large, they don't care. Just get it out as plainly as possible. I saw porn. I looked at porn, and then just like that. And if it happens several times, just say six times. Don't dwell on it. Don't go on about it. Just toss it out there, and then you'll be able to go back to communion. Until you fall the next time, which with any luck and with any perseverance and with any prayer, the periods between will grow. The intervals will grow. And but it's a deep-seated problem, and it takes a long, long time to reduce, let alone eradicate. But it can be done. And I would urge you never to give up hope. One of the things that the devil uses on us, and people forget this, it isn't just about luring you with beauty. It's also about making you despair over the remorse you feel afterwards. See, that's the thing that he really gets his jollies off of. And if he can, I mean, it was his great joy with Judas. Judas's the sin that sent Judas to hell was not betraying our Lord. It was not. It was despairing of our Lord's forgiveness and thinking, oh, my sins are so great, he can't forgive me, or he won't forgive me. That's not true. Not true at all. So, and as I say, also try to keep it in perspective. You know, it's not what your life is defined by, it's not who you are. It's an aberration, it's a failing like everybody else has. You'll have a hard time finding any man Jack or Lady Jane on this earth who doesn't have some sinful inclination towards something or other. In that sense, we're all very like one another. So the biggest thing is not to feel that you're alone or that you're somehow more disgusting than the rest of mankind. You're not. You're just, you know, your fallen nature is trying to do what your fallen nature is always trying to do, which is to drag you to hell any way possible. And if it's not that, it'll be something else. My little joke, you know, is that the devil only tempts us with what we find tempting. He rarely uses temptations on us that really aren't going to work. You know, you can have all this spam, cans and cans of spam, all to yourself. No, I don't think so, Satan, but thanks for the offer. Are you sure you can have it all? Yeah, I'll manage.
Funny. You know what that reminds me of is one of the books we carry in our store on Saint Anthony of the Desert. And I was always so amused at one of the temptations, because he had a lot of encounters with the devil. And one of the temptations was just this big, the devil put this big silver disc in the desert as a temptation. And I always thought that was so amusing because it's so random. Like, what is Saint Anthony going to do with a big silver disc? You know?
Who's to say?
Like, there's not like a marketplace where he can go to. I mean, like, he's so far removed from any worldly comfort or materialism that, like, a big silver disc, really? That was.
Well, but see, that's if nothing else, that's a good parable for the fact that the temptations, the things that tempt other people, when they don't tempt us, we find silly, ridiculous, or grotesque.
That's true. Yeah.
You know, we think, what sort of a moron would be interested in that? But
Yeah.
our own temptations make perfect sense.
It's very true.
That's the way we are. So, listen, Anonymous, don't give up hope. No matter how many times you fall, the trick is getting up again. That's an old cliche, but it's very true.
And since we're talking about confession, I mean, the one thing that hits me, hit that's been hitting me recently is the concept of mercy, because you know, you try to pay it forward, you try to understand and fathom the mercy God has shown you, going to confession numerous times and forgiving you. Just countless times. And then trying to have mercy on other people. And by that I mean, more specifically for me, participating in the corporal acts of mercy. You see? I think I might have talked about this before, where a person from, let's say, a person from prison was asking for books, and someone had told me, "Oh, he's just trying to take advantage of you." And I mean, that's kind of true, but I thought about that all day, the entire day. He's just trying to take advantage of you, and then I thought, well, I'm just taking advantage of God in confession. You know what I mean? Like everybody's
Oh.
taking trying to take advantage of whatever they can get, and it there's no it's not necessarily logical to do a corporal act of mercy. It's just an act of the will, right? You see? And it's not about whether the person is deserving or not. That's another area of it too. It's like, oh, I'm only going to give to people who deserve.
Which, please God, I won't be treated that way, because who could fathom who deserves?
Yeah.
We're all sinners in the eyes of God, and that means in reality. So, and in that sense, in our misery, there is a kind of human solidarity that we forget about.
Yeah.
We don't think about the fact that our most miserable were the most like our fellow man.
That's right.
So, for you, Anonymous, thank heaven you're not Twiggy. I wouldn't want to be having this kind of discussion with her. But I will say that, you're fighting a difficult fight, but it's one of the most common in your age group and gender. So just keep at it, keep at it, keep at it. And it'll take a long time, possibly, or not. Sometimes people lose the craving to a greater degree. I mean, you're going to be dealing with this as long as you're in the flesh. You're not going to escape it entirely by any means. But sometimes there's a notable lessening of it. And of course, when you get older, the urges get much less driving, which is why I've always thought it was the devil who invented Viagra. I really do. Because here, at last, you've reached a time in your life where that becomes somewhat less driving, and you can begin to get your internal affairs in order for the great departure, the night train to the big adios, as Sid Hutchins tells us in L.A. Confidential, that heartwarming family film. But with Viagra, people act as stupid at 60 as they did at 16. So I think that that's not a good thing at all.
Okay.
But at any rate, that was a heartwarming family film, though.
LA Confidential? You're gonna get
Oh,
busted on that one.
yeah. Gotcha there. You know what James Ellroyd said about
I don't know who that is, but what'd
it?
he
He's the
say?
author of the book that the movie was made from.
What'd he say?
Well, he said it's a family film. If you're part of the Manson family.
Ah, right.
He calls himself the White Knight of the Far Right.
The author does?
Yeah.
Wow. The White Knight of the Far Right. That's pretty epic. I like that.
Well, he's a funny guy. I mean, he's kind of lewd in some of his remarks, but he's funny. I met him a couple of times. He's a funny guy.
All right. Question from Nicholas.
Yeah.
Hello, gentlemen. I was wondering if Charles could discuss the life of Maximilian I, Holy Roman Emperor, and if he may, with the permission of Mr. Vincent the Questionnaire Franchini, I would like to encourage him to take as much time as possible to include many details, and if he could, recommend any good books on Maximilian that are worth reading. So, yes, you have my permission, Charles.
That's very kind of you. Well, let's start from the end. Offhand, I can't think of any books per se. I'm sure there are some. And of course, the Archduke Otto von Habsburg's book on Charles V does deal in the beginning with Maximilian I, who Maximilian I was the grandfather of the Emperor Charles V. He was a Habsburg, and he was born the Lord of Austria and so on. But it was in his reign that the although he ran out of money pretty quick in his various wars, but they called him the Last Knight, Knight. He lived in the 1400s, and he what's the word I want? Died in 1518, and his life was very difficult in some ways, but he really laid the foundations for the universal empire of his grandson. As I say, he was Holy Roman Emperor, and he was the lord of the Habsburg territories, but he married a lady named Mary of Burgundy, and she was the heiress to what are now the Netherlands, Burgundy, Alsace, a big chunk of territory between Switzerland and Holland, Burgundy. And that, when she married Maximilian, that was put the seal on Habsburg ascendancy, the Burgundian inheritance. And with her also came the grand mastership of a chivalric order, which the Habsburgs have to this day. And that is the Order of the Golden Fleece. So the two of them had a son named Philip of Burgundy, also called Philip the Handsome, apparently because he looked good. Now, you remember Ferdinand and Isabella of Christopher Columbus fame.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they had a single daughter who was called Juana la Loca, Crazy Joan. But she fell in love with young Philip. And they were an item. And they got married. And they produced a son, Carlos, who became the king of Spain. But his father died young, which really pushed his mother over the edge. So he was raised pretty much by his grandfather, Ferdinand. Not raised by him, but he was advised by him. He was raised by his other grandfather, Maximilian. And when his grandfather, Ferdinand, died, he went to Spain and became king. And he didn't really speak Spanish. He spoke French and Dutch and German. But he got Hispanicized pretty quickly. Meanwhile, his grandfather, Maximilian, lived on and built some interesting things. I've been to his tomb in Wiener Neustadt, Austria. It was kind of a funny story, really, because the church he's in is now the military cathedral of Austria. You know, every Catholic country and some non-Catholic ones, like the United States, have a diocese for the armed forces. Well, the Cathedral of St. George in Wiener Neustadt is the cathedral for the military diocese in Austria. But part of his will that endowed the place was that Mass would always be said on his tomb, which was built in the form of an altar. But then came Vatican II. So there's the quote-unquote people's altar, where they say the new Mass, rather than Mass on the old altar, which is over his tomb, which was required by his will, which left the money for the endowment for the place in the first place. So it was interesting. I was taken on a tour of the place by one of the local army officers, retired. And he said that that bothered him a lot. And it had nothing to do with Tridentine versus Novus Ordo. It's just that the will required that the Mass would be said on the tomb over his body every day, which obviously they're not doing because they're using the other altar. So he said, I don't know what you would call that. I said, oh, I do. I'd call it fraud. But at any rate, Maximilian died almost penniless. So the beautiful tomb he had built for himself in Innsbruck, he did not, He was buried, as I say, in Neustadt. And when he died, there was another imperial election for the first time in quite some time. There were two other candidates against his grandson Charles, and they were Francis I, the King of France, and Henry VIII, the King of England, who both ran for Holy Roman Emperor. They both lost. And Charles, King of Spain, became Holy Roman Emperor and the first man of whom it could be said that the empire, the sun could not set on his empire. As for Maximilian, when I first got here in 2018, the country was in the throes of the 500th anniversary celebration of his demise in 1518. So it was the year of Maximilian when I first got here, and they were talking about him all over the place.
All right. A bunch of questions from Diego.
Ah, does he mention Twiggy?
No. As the 30th day of January has passed, I will ask more about the Stuarts, and especially King Charles I, because anytime I watch documentaries or any historical media, they always say the following: Charles I was a weak king, a tyrant, easily manipulated. Everything was done for him, hated by his people, and of course, being popish. Ultimately, this leads to an underlying hatred of the Catholic Church and no doubt work of the evil one. Still, go over what Charles did right, what he could have done better, and finally, how he was able to cultivate such wonderful facial hair that makes me envious.
Well, I'll deal with the last first. I have no idea.
On how he handled the facial hair?
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know, genetics. So the as far as the rest of it goes, the charges always cancel each other out. Which is it? Is he a weak king or is he a tyrant? It can't be both, morons, my little munchkins of academia, my little mental midgets. You really can't do everything that's ascribed to him at once, the way the moronic academia little creatures like to say. The truth is, how do I put it? He was faced with enormous opposition. You see, you gotta go back in time for a minute. When Henry VIII gave away all those monastery lands to his quote unquote followers, his quote unquote followers became the foundation of a new oligarchy that would dominate England and would dominate Parliament and in the end would defeat and destroy the king. It's interesting that Henry VIII's prime agent in destroying the monasteries was a man named Thomas Cromwell. Thomas Cromwell's great nephew Oliver would preside over the murder of Charles I. So, as far as that went, by the time Charles I became king, Parliament was pretty much in the pockets of the Puritan slash what would later be Whig oligarchy. And it was a question of who was to be supreme. But the truth was, they had the money. And at the end of the day, for him to have defeated them quickly and easily would have required someone who was extremely ruthless and was, in fact, a tyrant. Sadly, because he wasn't a tyrant, he didn't do it and suffered the consequences of the lack of tyranny. Now, as far as being a weak king goes, no, doesn't fit. He called his first parliament. He soon realized he wasn't going to be able to do business with them. So what did he do? He dissolved parliament. And for 10 years, he ran the country without parliament. It was called the King's Peace, his direct rule. And never since then has England been such a happy country as when the king ruled it without parliament. It's worth looking up. It's worth looking up the details. For Catholics, it was particularly a good time. Why? Because persecution of us ceased. And it was interesting, he inherited a number of Catholic priests in jail in London from his father. Well, the anti-Catholic feeling was enormous at that time. So he didn't feel that he could simply release them. But what he did was allowed them to visit their flocks during the day. And they would come back and sleep in the prisons at night. And that went on for the 10 years of the king's personal rule. But he was faced with a lot of problems he had inherited from his father and from Elizabeth. We could tick them off in some detail. First, there was Ireland. Now, as any Irishman will tell you, Ireland is trouble for anyone who wants to run it. There's a reason Officer Clancy came to California. Hatred between the Irish and the English was bad enough when they had the same religion. But then when the Protestant revolt turned Catholic Protestant, turned England Protestant, rather, for the most part, the element of religious bitterness came into it. You had the 9 Years' War and the defeat of the Earls of Tyrconnell and Tyrone, the flight of the Earls in 1602. And then you had James I planting the Ulster Scots in Ulster. That, in turn, led to the very bloody rising of 1641, by which time the king was having trouble of his own in England. In the end, he would come. His supporters in Ireland would come to an agreement with the so-called Confederation of Kilkenny, which was the union of the Irish Catholic folk. But initially, the uprising in 1641 was against the royal authority and the Protestants. But as the war in England wore on, the sides switched. And the Irish Catholics and the Anglicans supported the king. And the Presbyterians supported Cromwell. That was in Ireland. In Scotland, there was an interesting problem. And the interesting problem was that when James I was King of Scotland and inherited England, he was already the head of the Church of Scotland, which was Presbyterian. He became head of the Church of England, which was Anglican. He decided he would give the Church of Scotland bishops with the idea of slowly transforming it into an Anglican church. Now, Charles I had some very definite ideas religiously. He believed that the church whose leadership he had inherited from his father was a Catholic church. He believed that his religion was the same as that of the Pope. How do we know this? Because we've got his letters. We know that he hated the schism between Rome and England. One of the interesting things he said to one of his ministers is that I would give my right hand not to have had Henry break with Rome. And his minister said, "Oh, surely you don't mean that, Your Majesty." He said, "Indeed I do. I would give my own hand, eye and my head as well, for it not to have happened." And as you can guess, this was something that would be remembered later, because he did. He kept up negotiations with Rome throughout his reign. And, of course, that added to the hatred that the Protestants had for him, that the Puritans had for him. In 1639, he attempted in a serious way to Anglicanize the Church of Scotland with a new liturgy based on the Book of Common Prayer. Now, it's important to remember that he had been trying to Catholicize the Church of England. We forget just how Protestant it was when he inherited the throne. So he appointed a man named William Laud as Archbishop of Canterbury, who started putting the communion tables up against the wall, surrounding them with rails, none of which had been the case before. In other words, giving it more of a Catholic-esque setup. He wanted to do the same thing in Scotland. And Scotland was particularly dear to him because he'd been born there when his father was King of Scots. Remember, his father inherited the English throne because Elizabeth died without children. And through his mother, the ill-fated Mary Queen of Scots, James was the closest heir to the throne. So, what happened was that the Presbyterians in Scotland revolted against the king's religious attempts up there and began what was called the Bishops' War. Well, now, he had run England for 10 years from his own estates and hadn't called Parliament because he was very careful not to do anything that would require money beyond what he could produce himself. But a war, that meant he would have to call Parliament because they'd have to pay for it. Only they could authorize the raising of new taxes. So he called Parliament. But Parliament was firmly in the hands of his enemies. So it started out as a war with the Scots, turned into that Parliament demanding control of the kingdom. And they started by forcing the king to allow the execution of both his right-hand man, the Earl of Strafford, and Archbishop Laud. Oh, and by the way, when this Long Parliament, as it was called, took over, all those priests I mentioned in jail in London, all executed. Eventually, he couldn't take any more, and he raised the standard at, gosh, where did he raise it? Newbury? No, I forget where he raised it, but he raised it. And the king and parliament went into war. And that was the beginning of what used to be called the British Civil Wars, and now has the much more poetic name of the Wars of the Three Kingdoms. So that was Charles the First. One of the other things that he opposed, the peasants of England were being driven off the land to what was called the enclosures. Briefly, what that meant was that in every manor, you had the plots of land worked by the tenants, but you had a common area, the common, where everybody could graze their sheep or whatever other animals they had. And this was absolutely essential to their living there. Now, the common lands technically belonged to the lord of the manor, but practically speaking, were used by everyone. Well, the enclosures allowed the lords of the manor to enclose that common land so that the tenants couldn't use it. What that meant was that they couldn't support themselves. And what that meant was that you could throw them off the land and replace them with sheep, wool being much more profitable than people at that time. Well, the king fought very hard against this, just as he fought for the, as he saw it, the Catholic nature of the Church of England and the reunion of the Church of England with the Church of Rome. And it cost him his head. That was Charles the First. If he had been willing to consent, even at the end, to abolishing the office of bishops in the Church of England, they would have let him live, but he refused. And so they murdered him. And that was the story of Charles the First. A much, much better man than all of his enemies put together, and all of his critics since.
All right, next question. I was unaware that moderns actually divided themselves between cavalier and roundhead as lifestyles. Honestly, when I first read about cavaliers and roundheads as a little boy, I just choose cavaliers because they looked nicer with their wide-brimmed plumed hats, their colorful clothing, and the horses. Ah, yes, simpler times. Have Charles explain the difference between cavaliers and roundheads, Vincent. Charles, please explain the difference between cavaliers and roundheads.
Well, as long as you put it that way, okay. Well, basically, what I said earlier about Charles the First, you could tell a lot about a given leader by his adherents. And the Cavaliers, as the supporters of Charles the First were called, were wild people. They were not always the most disciplined of men. They're mostly high Anglicans and Catholics, and very fun-loving and adventurous is the devil may care, if you will, is the reputation they have to this day. What they call what's the word? Well, they used to have the phrase, even when I was a kid, having a cavalier attitude towards something. In addition, they had a whole, for want of a better word, school of poetry called the Cavalier Poets, who were poets who had fought for the king. And as it happens, one of these was a gentleman called Richard Lovelace. And he wrote a poem when he was stuck in prison in the Tower of London by the opponents. And so he wrote this to one of his lady loves. And I'm going to read it simply because it was one of my favorite poems in college. But it gives, I think, a feeling for the spirit of the men who fought for Charles I. To Althea from prison. And bear in mind, he's in the Tower. When unconfined wings hovers within my gates, and my divine Althea brings to whisper at the grates. When I lie tangled in her hair and fettered to her eye, the gods that wanton in the air know no such liberty. When flowing cups run swiftly round with no allaying Thames, our careless heads with roses bound, our hearts with loyal flames. When thirsty grief in wine we steep, when hells and draughts go free, fishes that tipple in the deep know no such liberty. When, like committed linnets, I with shriller throat shall sing the sweetness, mercy, majesty, and glories of my king. When I shall voice aloud how good he is, how great should be, and largèd winds that curl the flood know no such liberty. Stone walls do not a prison make, nor iron bars a cage. Minds innocent and quiet take that for an hermitage. If I have freedom in my love, and in my soul I'm free, angels alone that soar above enjoy such liberty. That was the spirit of the Cavalier. Now, let's look at the other side. The Roundheads. Well, where the Cavaliers wore their hair long, the Roundheads did not. They weren't the way I do. They were Puritans. Their prayers were long and spontaneous. They gave themselves names like Sword of the Lord and Justice. And the chicks had names like Chastity and Penury. Well, no, not Penury, but names like that. Very annoying. They were like, I mean, Cromwell was the arch Puritan, and it was their seed that settled New England as well. And a lot of the American mentality comes to us from them. Not just our hatred of monarchy, but our suspicion of beauty and art and goodness. A lot of unpleasantry in our national character comes to us from the Puritan background. And there is a certain amount of truth to the old saying that while Cavalier and Roundhead were political positions, they were also, in a sense, personality types as well. The Roundhead always loves sticking his nose elsewhere into other people's business, so to speak. I think it was H.O. Mencken who defined Puritanism as the fear that someone, somewhere, someplace might be enjoying themselves. Whereas for the Cavalier, pleasure and enjoyment was part and parcel of the whole thing. And the thing about the Puritan asceticism is that it was as different from the asceticism of the saints as misogyny is from celibacy. The Cavaliers were quite capable of giving up lesser goods for greater ones. For the Puritans, the world was simply evil and fallen. So there you are. There's the difference.
Okay. All righty. Last question for today. Being born in these United States, I am Anglo in upbringing, unfortunately by my own accord, and forming. This means I have more Protestant views on life ingrained in me and speak English first. However, I am Hispanic in origin by birth, which means that undying loyalty, devotion, fortitude, and resolve are in my nature with decent Spanish-speaking skill. Now, the only thing that I know in keeping these elements of mine in check and united is Christ. Without the Catholic faith, I doubt any real peace and unity will be achieved. And with further expansion of different cultures on my list, the faith will be the sole keeper of that unity I'd like to strive for. My question is it better to put more emphasis on achieving unity through Christ, striving towards bringing more people to Christ, or rather putting more emphasis on living a Catholic life better, for example, trying one's best to imitate Christ? I like to hold both Charles I of Spain and of England near and dear to my heart, even though Spain and England are mortal enemies. Or will my wonder for Clovis and Franks never be fully enjoyed, because to my soft spot for Recared and the Visigoths, and due to Spain and France being mortal enemies?
Well, you know, I understand the feeling very much myself, being French-Canadian on my father's side, and Austrian and Irish and Scots and English and various other things on my mother's side. I understand completely how you feel. Also, by virtue of being, as it were, Canadian and American at the same time. And this is an increasing phenomenon, given the way that peoples have mixed and matched over the past century. And I'm sure it'll continue to be. But the answer to your question as to which of the two methods you mentioned you should pursue, the answer is both. The faith does give unity, and it allows you the luxury of being able to revere honorable men of whatever nationality, devout men of whatever nationality, regardless of whence they came from, or even if they were opposed to each other. Why? Well, because you look at people like St. Wilfrid of York and St. Bernard of Clairvaux, who disliked one another intensely, or St. Augustine and St. Jerome, who later made it up, but originally, I mean, they were just hammer and tongs. But as they achieved sainthood, we were able to venerate them all equally, despite their earthly opposition to each other. And so, too, with the great heroes of Catholic Europe and Latin America, for that matter. Their shared faith with each other and with us allows us to venerate them equally. Ecclesia Patria Nostra, the Church is our country. And living a Catholic life is simply part and parcel of citizenship. You know, it's just, it's like saying, you know, do I evangelize or do I try to imitate Christ? It's like saying, do I vote or do I pay my taxes? You see, you've got kind of a false dichotomy there.
When you imitate Christ, you become that shining city on a hill. You can't hide it, right?
Yeah, it's true. Yeah. Hide your light under a bushel, the way Christ never said. And you will attract other people to you. So, and the other thing too is that remember that you are the sum total of everything that came before, but you're also an individual. I was just reading something by the fellow who wrote The Remains of the Day. He's a Japanese fellow who's lived his entire life in England. And he said something which has a bearing on this. Kazuo Ishiguro is his name. And Kazuo Ishiguro, Japanese parents raised in Britain. And he made some observations which I think are really worth mentioning. He says, when asked about his identity, quote, "People are not two-thirds one thing and the remainder something else. Temperament, personality, or outlook don't divide quite like that. The bits don't separate clearly. You end up a funny homogeneous mixture. This is something that will become more common in the latter part of the century. People with mixed cultural backgrounds and mixed racial backgrounds. That's the way the world is going." But having said that, and this is also, I think, worthwhile, he made the point in an interview after the announcement of the Nobel Prize. Ishiguro said, quote, "I've always said throughout my career that although I've grown up in this country, Britain, and I'm educated in this country, that a large part of my way of looking at the world, my artistic approach, is Japanese, because I was brought up by Japanese parents speaking in Japanese. And, quote, I have always looked at the world through my parents' eyes." I think those are very important for all of us of very mixed cultural and ethnic backgrounds. We all do get something from each of what we are, but that, if you will, multiplicity of substantial ethnicities is something that goes to making us the individuals that we are. And also bearing in mind that God knew from all eternity that it was going to work out this way and designed each of us for the specific backgrounds we were born to. It's not like he was vacationing in Tibet and blinked when you were born. So be assured, if you look at your background and say, gosh, what does it all mean? It means you are what you were supposed to have been. That's what it means. Am I French? Am I Austrian? Am I Irish or Scots? Am I English? Am I Canadian? Am I American? I'm all those things. All of them at once. And above them all, I'm Catholic. And that's what makes Charles A. Coulomb of that ilk who he is. And the way, of course, I've chosen to apply it. My brother has the same background, but he's applied it differently because he's a different individual. And that's the way we are. And in this brave new world of ours, we each of us have an obligation to bring to the table the best of what we came with, no matter how mixed that might be. Even if you were, oh, I don't know, Italian, Slovak, and Magyar at once. I know it's hard to imagine such a weird mixture.
Cute, Charles. Very cute.
What? Not just saying. But if you think about it, if you took any of those elements away, neither you nor Steve would be who you are.
Never thought of it like that.
No, but it's true. Each of them played a very important role in making you the man you are. And again, you and Steve, taking it just like my brother and me, you and Steve have lived the life that that background gave you rather differently. But even so, you can see, if you want to sit down and think about it, in a sense, how each of you applied it. But you didn't sit around thinking about it because, as Ishiguro there says, it's you're a homogeneous whole. It's just that you come of this very mixed background. I mean, our ancestors at some point were people who had lived in a district all their lives, and generations of their people lived there before them. And they didn't know anything but their own culture and their own background.
Could you say that again? People who lived in a district. Could you just say that last point again?
Well, at some point, we have ancestors, all of us, on one side or the other, or on all sides, who lived all their lives and probably generations of their family before them in one little district, speaking that language with that culture, that folklore. And that was it. That was as far as it went. And they did that for a very long time. Then something happened. In our cases, they came to the New World, never realizing that they would have descendants who would be their descendants, but also descendants of people with whom they had almost no connection at all. And yet it happened. And the results are us. One of my little jokes is that we Americans, and it's true also of Canadians, Australians, New Zealanders, Argentines, and all the rest of the settler countries, the daughter nations, we are the most European of the Europeans because they're all particularly tied to a certain area. We're not. We come from all over. And if we've been so much more if we've been away for a long time. I mean, on my mother's side, well, my mother's father's side, I'm much closer to Europe than on my dad's side. I mean, my father's family came to Quebec in the 17th century. You know, they've His most recent immigrant ancestor was Scots and came to Canada in 1772. That's the most recent. The new blood, the newbies. So there, the length of time they've been in North America, they've been out of Europe. That's another thing to consider. But at any rate, God made each of us who we are and the position we're in. And we've got to realize he did the same with everybody else.
It's true. All right. We have reached the end of the episode.
Not quite.
What do you got for us?
I want to make an appeal to everyone out there. I think we've come to a time now, we're at a crisis point in the history of our country, in the history of the world, European history, Asian history, African history. I think that right now everything is coming to this juncture, to this crucial turning point, at which we, all of us, in our own way, have to pull together and do one important thing. Feed Twiggy.
Okay. That's okay. That's okay. I thought you were going to say something about Murray Schultz, but that's fine. Yeah. Feed Twiggy.
Oh, so now you want to hear about Murray Schultz. Well, it's Schwartz for one thing.
Schwartz, excuse me.
And Murray Schwartz has had enough abuse for one day from you. And when it wasn't abuse, it was neglect. Almost as bad as what you did with Twiggy, that neglect.
I can't help it between abuse and neglect. Sometimes I'm like Edward Scissorhands,
If I had twins, I would name them abuse and neglect. No, seriously, folks. We're steaming through Lent. We're roller coastering toward the Paschal Mystery. Here in Trumau, we've got the Byzantine Liturgy of the Presanctified, the Tridentine Mass, the Syro-Malabar Kurbana, the Novus Ordo in Latin. It's a liturgical cornucopia, which I love, I really do. We don't know what the future holds, but that's always been the case, ladies and gentlemen. Which is why we have to pray a lot. Look forward to Easter. Look backward to Christmas. The thing about times like these is that they make the underlying realities of life, which we normally ignore, they do force us to look at them. So that's actually a good thing, not a bad thing. So don't be worried. It's not really as though anything has changed. It's just that things have been made obvious. We don't like that. It's unfortunate. We're not happy about that. But be of good cheer. This is the day that the Lord has made. Rejoice and be glad in it. All right, well, that leaves one question to be asked. Actually, two. Can you guess what they are?
Yes, I'm going to ask you it. If it's Monday, what is it?
Well, I would say chances are it's off the menu.
But what about the soul you save?
Aha. There I've got some insight. It may very well be your own.
See you next time, everyone.
God bless you all. Take care. And don't let the roundheads grind you down. Stay cavalier.